Okay, this is Richard S., and I'm at my house in Bellevue, Kentucky. It's June 27th of 2023, and today David L. is with us, and he is going to talk about what Alcoholics Anonymous was like when he came in, perhaps some of the history and his experiences and how he got involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll see how it rolls. So welcome, David, for coming.
Thank you, Richard.
Yep. And what was a typical day for you like before you got to AA?
Oh, it was getting, days were getting smaller and smaller all the time. I had fewer and fewer places that I went. I mean, it was like a rat in an electrified cage, you know, like I would have, sometimes I got in trouble and I'd have to go take care of that, but sometimes I didn't have any money, I'd have to go sell something, and but usually it was just a trip to the nearby bar, I mean nearby, no more than 50 feet away from my house, I rented that house on Calhoun Street over in Cincinnati, near the University of Cincinnati, because it was essentially close to a bar. I didn't let on that was the reason, because I was married to a woman who didn't like the fact that neither of us were using the word alcoholism, but she thought I drank too much, and she thought that she noticed that I'd already gotten in trouble for that down in Athens, Ohio, where I was a graduate student at Ohio University, and I came up to Cincinnati to teach at UC, and I thought I'd heard stories about Cincinnati cops being even tougher than the ones down in Athens, which wouldn't be hard to do. And I'd been stopped and arrested a couple of times down in Athens for driving while, a little too relaxed. And so I thought, if I come to Cincinnati and I'm taking a job teaching at UC, I want to get close enough to the university so I can walk to work. It would narrow the window of opportunity for getting in trouble, I thought. But of course, I couldn't tell the truth. I was anti-honesty in those days. And she would look at she looked at his house and thought, oh goodness, it was a little narrow, skinny row house, and just about 15 feet wide and three stories really. They had a basement that was a kind of a storage area and a kitchen. First floor was a living room and a study, and the second floor was two bedrooms, and that was it. And the plaster was falling off the ceiling down in the basement in the kitchen, and actually fell in our soup one day, you know, a little chunk of plaster. So we were not wanting for fiber. So she thought, this is a terrible place. And she was pregnant. She was pregnant with our first and only child. And this is not a good environment to bring a newly pregnant lady into. And she looked, shook her head, and you know, said, oh, goodness, why can't we do any better than this? And I didn't want to tell her the truth, because I wanted to minimize my troubles with transportation, you know, just walking across the street to work. And so I looked around and just thrashing around for a justification for why we want to rent this cheesy old row house. And I looked up, and there was a skylight that sort of lit the central stair, the little two-story staircase. And I said, look, this is probably indicates this is a pre-Civil War house, that skylight lighting the stair. It echoes, it's in shape, the skylight that lights the second floor bathroom. And I said, this is an interesting architectural feature. And I'm afraid if somebody else rents it, they wouldn't appreciate it. So I like it for that reason. And of course, what the real reason was the transportation thing and staying out of trouble. And the fact that it was right next door to a bar, Mormon's, we call it Mormon's Tabernacle, of course. And it was right next door to, on the other side, to a carryout where there was a bookie joint right next to me, and then two doors down there was a carryout. So surrounded by a bookie, a carryout, and a bar, and close to the university, so I could walk across the street. And none of this could I tell her directly. I always had to obfuscate.
Well, what happened to get you to AA?
Well, I had enough trouble. I got, the trouble was the thing that finally did it. I got a couple of DUIs. I got locked up in the old workhouse. That was an experience. It was I almost feel sorry for people who were denied that experience. Speaking of the Civil War, that was built supposedly to house POWs from the South, you know, who would, the North, the Yankees had captured.
I chaired a meeting there.
They had to put them somewhere, and they had that's where they put them. So I got to occupy for a short while one of the cells that no doubt a straw mattress that a old Confederate soldier once slept on, probably same straw. So I got locked up, and I got in trouble. I got a probation officer, and she said, "You know, this is 1974. And she said, "I think you're a candidate for AA." And I said, "Oh, I don't know." And then she says, "Yeah, you are. You gotta go." So I went. I went once, I think, or twice, and I came back and I used a wily kind of a nonsense argument with her. I mean, I wouldn't think of talking this way now, because I understand how manipulative I was being. And I noticed this in other people that I see, newcomers sometimes. Not everybody's like this, and not everybody uses it the way I was using it, but I made the religious objection. I said, "I don't think it's legal for you to obligate me to a religious outfit, a religious organization. I think it's a violation of some kind of rule or law or something. Seems anti-constitutional somehow." And so her eyes got big, and she said, "Well, all right," you know, like she backed up, and she says, "We'll work out something else." But nothing ever got worked out. You know, I never had to do anything much else. But then I got my second DUI, and there I am again with the same PO. And Peg Ryder was her name. She's not a recovering person, so I can say her name out loud. But Peg said this time around, you know, this is 4 years later, I think it was 1978, and she said, "I want you to try AA again, and here's a guy I want you to find, and here's the meeting I want you to go to." And she directed me to another guy that she was had on probation, who's still my sponsor from late 77, early 78. Buzz S. And it was a terrific match, because he was as irreverent and peculiar in his take on the world as I was, and so he kind of guided me. "Take what you like and leave the rest" was my mantra in those days. You know, if somebody was coming on with something that I'd found unpalatable, Buzzy would say, just shine it on, and don't worry about it, don't think about it too much, just wait till somebody else starts talking, or wait till, but don't leave the meeting. Just hold on, and something useful will happen. You'll learn something. And he advised me to try to figure out what it was I was at that meeting to learn. And that was a good discipline. But he also suggested I just put subtitles over people's language, if they were talking in a way that I didn't like or I didn't understand. If I could sense what they were up to, and if they had a good intention and a good heart, I could do that and not feel upset or repelled by it. But I was a prickly soul when I was first coming around to AA, always looking for a reason to leave, trying to get in arguments with people and all that. I remember going to Oak Street once, and I had been advised to talk to people who just give it a lead, because they're kind of warmed up and they're willing to talk to anybody. Usually, especially if you go up and say, "Nice going, I like what you had to say." I've noticed that people will continue talking. And I did that with this guy, and I wish I could remember who it was, because he did the valuable teaching thing, tool with me. I said, the steps are on a great big, like a roller blind behind the podium there at Oak Street, and I pointed to the one about taking a searching and fearless moral inventory, and I said, "Do you believe that?" And he said, "Oh, absolutely, I think it's important. I think it's anything. If you don't do that, you probably won't be able to stay sober." And so I said, "Now, what about this idea that it's a disease? You believe that too?" And he says, "Yeah, I do." I said, he says, "We generally, most of us believe that." And I said, "Well, how can that be?" And I thought I was pretending anyway to improve the intellectual rigor of AA. I was going to tune it up. I was going to make it more consistent internally. And I said, "What kind of disease is it that requires a searching and fearless moral inventory anyway? I mean, have you ever heard of that with cancer or diabetes or heart disease? I mean, after all, And I was so proud of myself. I thought, boy, I'm really cooking. I'm making sense here. And what he did at that point, he stopped talking to me, and he just took me by the elbow, gently, and he says, he didn't say anything. He just, he began walking toward the front door, and I followed him because he had me by the elbow. And he points to the Vernon Manor across the street, and he said, as far as I know, that's the nearest bar to here. And he says, he says, if you want to drink, drink. He says, we're gonna be here, you know, when you get done. And he says, and if you don't have any money, I'll give you something. And
wow.
Damnest thing. Because I was thinking, I'm going to get into such a world-class argument, Olympic-style argument, you know, that I'm going to either confound everybody, they're going to say we should rethink the steps, and we can throw out that searching, fearless, moral inventory stuff. Because if it's a disease, after all. And either I win the argument and I altered AA forever for the better, or the guy gets angry and throws me out. And I thought number two was really my choice. That was the door I was hoping would open. And he understood that I wanted an argument, and he refused to give it to me. And it was such a wise thing. I don't know that I've ever gotten to be that wise, you know, like mm-hmm. 43 years later of continuous sobriety. I don't know if I still can master my emotions if I feel directly challenged by somebody. I want to get at them, you know. But he didn't.
You mentioned 43 years. What is your sobriety date?
January 4th, 1980.
Wow.
And I wish it were actually in 1978 when I first came around. That's another whole story, because it... around Thanksgiving of 78, I finally went into treatment at Batesville, dear old departed Batesville. And a lot of people from Cincinnati used to go over to Batesville, Indiana. It's just inside the Indiana border, and it was Margaret Mary Hospital, Catholic hospital, had a treatment floor, and they I don't know when they started, it was maybe in the early 70s, 73, something like that. But it was very, very AA oriented, and it was a terrific, simple, direct program. And they had a speaker from AA come in just about every evening from the surrounding area, either from Indiana or Cincinnati, Greater Cincinnati, Kentucky too. And that was the thing that I began to look forward to. And I remember they showed a movie, it was way back in 1978, they showed a movie of a picnic, a bunch of sober people at a picnic, which I've, of course, seen many of since then. And at first I thought, this can't be true, because these people looked like they were relaxed and enjoying themselves and enjoying each other and enjoying the weather and, you know, just like regular people at a picnic, only not drinking. And I thought, how is it possible to live without drinking? You know, like to me, living without drinking was like proposing a solution to Jacques Cousteau just for fun, just as an experiment. Why don't we cut your oxygen line, you know, just for the hell of it, to see what happens? And you know, he wouldn't have gone along with that. And I was having a terrible time going along with the idea that I could live without this thing that was causing me by then so much trouble. You know, like the getting arrested and the not being able to work. You know, and not being able to tell sometimes in the winter. Late 77, 78, when I'm getting ready to go to treatment, sitting on my bed looking out the window of my dreary Calhoun Street house that by then I'm living in by myself, because the wife number one has correctly left and wife number two has also correctly left. I like to think I wouldn't have married anybody who didn't have a good sense to leave me, you know, when I was at my worst. And I there were times when I'd look out the window and it'd be 5 o'clock, and I wasn't sure, dead of winter, whether it was the one that's in the afternoon or the one that's in the morning.
How did you find AA when you came in? I mean,
well, I got probated to it. I got told by my probation officer that I had to go, and then I found my sponsor, and he began to take me by the hand and allow me to sort of. It wasn't full-fledged acceptance by any means. It took me probably a couple of years to realize that I wasn't there as a guest or a visitor. I wasn't doing research on, you know, understanding this interesting diversity of people and the curious ways they had of changing themselves and improving their lives. I had to, he helped me negotiate my way into it. I had to kind of do it kind of a sideways entry. I didn't jump in with both feet, for sure. I know, I've heard people say it, I believe them at meetings, that you know, I was there and I felt comfortable, I felt at home for the first time. That was not me. I can't say that honestly. But I did finally get there, and I began to enjoy it, and I thought, ooh, what I could do besides this, because I ended up relapsing at 13 months. I got in there in just after Batesville in late 78. I got into AA, and I was a reluctant warrior. You know, like I would show up two or three times a week instead of the probably five or six that I should have been doing. And I was still picking threads. I was finding fault with things. And I remember having come to Cincinnati to teach English at UC, I would react, you know, viscerally, practically, you know, when somebody would make a grammatical mistake, you know, at a discussion meeting. And I finally calmed down. I finally got myself to just be still and listen. And I thought, damn, people are making more sense than I'm used to, you know, way more sense than I could anticipate in the academic setting, way more sense than my fellow professors were making, whatever they taught, because they could use language to conceal meaning, you know, and without much trouble. And the people in AA were using language to transmit meaning, you know, to convey meaning, and because they wanted to be understood. They wanted people to hear them. And we wanted to listen. And it made a big difference. I just took the mistake filters off my ears, because that's what I was looking for, ways to separate myself, and I didn't have to. And it finally, I mean, this is old ideas available to nothing, and that was one of my old ideas, was that if I can be up on the, just a little bit elevated, up on the pitcher's mound, say, you know, then I can look down on other people, you know, that make me feel better, make me feel superior. And one of the sayings that I heard when I was first getting sober, that we are egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. And I needed to feel like I was up on the pitcher's mound, because I really couldn't stand myself. I thought I was a worthless piece of excrement, whale excrement, that's sitting at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, which is as far down as you can go.
You know, when I came in 87, they had the fifth chapter at Oak Street. Mm-hmm. I just remember so much enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. Meetings, you'd open the front door if you were late.
Oh, yeah.
That was about as far as you were going to get.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
standing room only.
It was packed. Yeah.
Did you find it?
Oh, absolutely. And there was joy there. There was excitement. And I was suspicious of that. I was wary of that. I thought, no way that these people, if they're real alcoholics, unless they're lying about being alcoholics, there's no way that alcoholics without alcohol, and I couldn't smell any around, you know, so it didn't seem like anybody was drinking, but there's no way they could be this damn happy. They must be handing out Valium in the basement or something, what I thought. And,
no, they were playing poker.
I know. It's a form of Valium if you're,
that's right.
If you're a successful gambler. And I always think a successful gambler is one who loses, because the guy who wins is the one who will continue with it forever. You know?
Did you find any people in AA that's stand out as people that really influenced your sobriety?
Oh God, there's so many of them. So many. I remember Furniture Jack used to give a lead. He'd have bottles standing up on the podium, and he'd put little dresses and little clothes on them, dress them up, and talk about how that's what they did to make themselves look attractive, you know? and he told a story once that it has stuck with me for probably 45 or 50 years, longer than I've been sober. He said he used to sleep in a deep freeze box, you know, cardboard box, and he says he felt sorry for these other chumps that had to sleep in like a washer or a dryer box and double themselves up to get in the box. He said, you know, in the lead, he said, if I ever get that bad, I'm going to quit. and then it's wonderful what sticks with you, you know, like the stories that you can't forget. They stick in your mind like harpoons. And that's one of them, and I'll think of more as we go along. But there were so many characters. Wilbur D was another one, who was a Navy veteran, and he took him a long time to get sober. I think they might have drummed him out of the Navy, I don't know, but he was a terrific guy, and he was a boilermaker. And he often wore coveralls, you know, when he'd speak, although occasionally he'd wear a suit, and he ended up being on the board at Prospect House. And once he was at a board meeting at Prospect House, and he took his, it turned out there was a problem with a hot water heater, and he was a boilermaker, and he understood plumbing and all that. And he left the board meeting, took his coat off and hung it on a chair, took his shirt off, hung it on a chair. And he went out and bought a hot water heater and brought it in and had the thing installed before the board meeting was over. And he said, he later reported back to the board, he said, "I thought that was the most useful thing I could do in the board meeting." And Wilbur, although he was a boilermaker, he was also had also gone to Duke, I think, and had studied the classics and could read Greek and read Latin.
Wow.
And he was most unusual man, very, very, very bright, very intelligent guy. But the cover, he loved the coveralls because it was like a protective armor, like a costume he wore. You know,
Carroll Shelby, the race driver.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and he was such a wonderful human being. Wilbur was a big help to me. You know, like another one was another board member of ours that we got a tree planted in her honor on the front lawn of the office, Elizabeth R. And Elizabeth had been an editor, had lived in London, and gave a very eloquent lead. You know, like I hung on every single word she said. Mm. And I went out to lunch with her, and she said, let me do you a favor. She says, "This is something that somebody did for me when I was first coming around." She said, "You've got somewhat similar tastes to mine." And she says, give me your AA little schedule. And she says, "Let me annotate it. Let me give you the meetings I think you'd like, that you'd be comfortable in." And I've tried to do that for other people, you know, rather than just giving them a schedule and say, "Here, go to town with 300 or 400 choices in front of you." It's an awful lot of, it's bewildering, you know, to a guy whose picker's broke anyway. You know, he will tell you, "I don't know, I can't even decide what to have for dinner, you know, let alone which meeting might work for me." But Elizabeth did that for me. She just put little check marks by the meetings that she thought I should try, because she said, "These are ones that I like and that I feel comfortable in." And it was flattering, because she divorced from an English husband. No, not divorced, she was a widow. The guy had, I think, died of alcoholism in London. And she had just fairly new in recovery and managed to get a handle on it. It was certainly running through her family. Terrific bunch of people.
Do you remember going to any meetings in Northern Kentucky when you were getting sober?
The place near the...
Russell Street.
Yeah, that was the one that was. It was like a. You were almost required to smoke if you went to Russell Street. I mean, you did smoke anyway, whether you were smoking or not. You know. I remember. It was a fairly big room, as I remember, and it was like a bar, like one of the. It had been a bar, I think.
It did.
And you, as you looked at the far reaches of the room in the corners, just to look for where the danger might be. You know, just as you would in a bar. There were sometimes you couldn't see the corners. and it was terrific. It was very warm and welcoming. And I remember we were talking about a member that just died over here, Tony D, just this 3 days ago. And he was, I believe I met him at Russell Street. And I don't know how many years he's got, but...
43.
Okay, well, he would have been in when I was in. And Tony had a way of making people feel welcome and shaking your hand and making a kind of a production out of it, you know, making the welcome to the new person was something special. It wasn't just perfunctory. It wasn't just nodding your head at him or something. Tony made a deal out of it, you know.
Well said.
Yeah. And that made that helped. It helped not just me, but now thousands of other people. I think, you know, like who. I think that's a really key part of how you get your footing inside AA. You know, it's such a peculiar organization when you think about it. It's the only club in the world that nobody wants to join, but then when you get in, you're really grateful that you're there. Mm-hmm. And it's the only club in the world where the thing that we have in common is that we can't do one particular thing at all. Not only just not well, but at all. We just can't do it. And that's the thing that unites this great diversity of people. You sit in a room in a big circle of people and you think, what in the world, if you were a documentary filmmaker and you were making a movie about this, what in the world do these people have in common? It is that they have one thing that they cannot do. And that's fascinating to me because we live in a culture. North America is a place where everybody's supposed to be made out of stainless steel and you're supposed to be able to do everything perfectly. And if you can't, it's your fault. If you're poor, it's your fault.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we live in such individualized ego towers, you know, that AA breaks through that. And it has a magic to it. And it's the place where a person's spirit can connect with another person's spirit. And I think that's priceless. There's nothing like that available anywhere else in the world for whatever money you pay for it. You can't find anything like that.
You gave me a definition of God. There's a wisdom within me that's older than I am, mm-hmm. that I've clung to.
Yeah.
And I thought, I get that.
Yeah, me too. That's one of those things that came to me gradually, and I, it's not just an idea or a belief. I just think it's a fact. There's something in there that's older and wiser than I am, and it wants me not to hurt myself, and wants me not to hurt other people, and wants to connect with that same thing that's in everybody. It ain't like I got a kind of a franchise on this, and I'm the only one who knows about it. I'm the only one that's got it. Everybody else got it too, you know, and I know that now, and I didn't used to know that.
Did you work? When you got sober, were you employed?
Oh, in a kind of a half-assed way. I was. I had a couple of part-time jobs. I was teaching for Wilmington College when I was drinking inside, and that was inside Lebanon Correctional. And there were times when I'd go to work and I'd be about halfway in the bag. I remember once a guy, I don't know whether he's alive or not, but he was the head of the Junior Chamber of Commerce. He was an inmate. He was the head of the Junior Chamber of Commerce inside the institution. They had a chapter of the Junior Chamber of Commerce. And he got busted. He had committed another crime inside the institution because he stole the treasury from the JCC. You know, he's which is very entrepreneurial of him. But he came up to me once and he said, brother, he says, you don't look so good. He says, here. And he produced a pair of sunglasses out of his shirt pocket and gave them to me to wear while I was teaching classes up there. He said, this cover up their bloodshot eyes. You know? when you depend on an inmate to provide you with cover, you know, for a disguise, you know, you know you're in trouble. And I think maybe wearing those sunglasses kept me from bleeding out. I don't know.
Well, I know a little bit about your work history, but and what I'm leading up to is Prospect House. Mm. How did you find out about Prospect House?
Well, my sponsor was already a board member there, and he was the guy that led me up there. And I don't think I would have found it on my own. I'd done a service commitment that my sponsor again had suggested to me and a couple other people. One guy wanted to get out of it. He wanted to slide away, and he was moving, leaving town anyway. This was finding leads to go into Roland's psychiatric hospital, mm-hmm. and talk and give a lead. And my job was to find somebody willing to go in and do it. And I would go in. I did it myself the first time just to test the waters and see what it was like so I could explain it to other people. It also made a terrific service commitment because it, I don't know if we did any good with it. I think we did. I think there were occasionally people would say, the light would come on and they'd say, oh, that's what's wrong with me too. Hmm. But I think what it did for me was it made me listen harder when I listened to a lead, because I thought, is this guy a candidate, or is this lady willing? Is she the kind of person who would say yes to a request to go into a mental hospital and give a talk? Because they say in AA that you're never supposed to say no to a question, a service question. But there are people who say no, you know, and I hate to be rejected. I hate to feel I propose something that somebody can't accept. So I tried to listen harder to find people who would say yes. And that was a terrific lesson in listening, you know. So I had to listen harder. And taking people inside Romans was a terrific discipline for me, because I had to do it. I alternated with somebody else. I had to do it every other Monday, I think. And that was very good for me. And that led into the next service commitment, which was volunteering to be on the board at Prospect House. And then by then, I was 81 or 82. And in 1984, I left the teaching job at Wilmington and got recruited to work by another board member at Prospect House, who said, "Why don't you come over to Bethesda? We're starting an IOP, intensive outpatient program." And so I worked there from 84 to 86, and that's how I got my feet wet in the treatment business. I started working there, and we were too convincing on the telephone. We'd have to explain to insurance companies that this IOP was a brand new idea back then. Now that's all they want to pay for, you know. What do you mean inpatient? What do you mean residential? You know, can't this fellow just thrive on two or three nights a week, you know, and get drunk in between? Which is unfortunately what some of us have figured out how to do. So anyway, I worked at Bethesda, and we oversold the idea of IOP to the insurance boys. And then I thought there was an opening. Jim Wood, wonderful old executive director, World War II vet. He was the guy who was running Prospect House at the time. And he came to me with the idea that there was going to be an opening there for a counselor. And we had breakfast two or three times at Frisch's and talked to some other board members. And this is while I'm working at Bethesda, and I'm feeling funny, like I got one foot in Bethesda and the other foot over in Prospect House, because I love the idea of working at a place where you didn't have to qualify somebody on an insurance basis. You know, you didn't have to say, "Have you got enough money? And if you don't have enough money, are you insured? And will your insurance cover this?" Because I get so worn out with that, because people came in just desperate, needing to quit and needing to change, and just falling apart right in front of you, you know, just delaminating, you know, right in our offices, you know, getting ready to change. And then we sometimes, too often, have to say, "I'm sorry, this is not a good fit for you." You know, what that meant was that we can't get paid.
Right.
And Prospect House was designed to work with indigent men, you know, from the region, you know, from Kentucky, Indiana, Cincinnati, everywhere. And I thought, wouldn't it be grand to work in a place where you can drop that qualification question of, you know, like, "Do you have any money? Do you have enough money? You know, do you have enough insurance?" Because we were by then, they had figured this out before me. I didn't contribute this. They had figured out a way to pay for that. You know, the combination of donations and rent that the guys would pay us when they finally got jobs. And the fact we had a little service company going at the time, and we'd go out and do quick apartment rehabs, paint jobs, you know, and sort of mush fake plumbing and stuff like that.
I was on the service crew,
we had ways to make money.
We were putting oil down on the Council on Alcoholism building,
yeah,
and set it on fire.
I heard about that. I heard about it well after the fact. God, if I'd known that at the time, it would have been driven me crazy. I think that was
fun. I know.
Oh, yeah. It was a guy who ran the service company. It was terrific. He was a funny guy. I finally did get my feet all the way into Prospect House, got on the board, and then served on the board, and then became president of the board, and did that from 81 to 86. And then when the opportunity to work there came, from 81 or 84 to 86, I was working at Bethesda, and then when 86, when the opening came as a counselor, I jumped at it, really. I was so happy to get into a work situation. This is one of my new rules. I never wanted to work again in a place that required a photo ID. Yeah.
Or took fingerprints.
Yeah, yeah. And I never had to have a photo ID at Prospect House. So that was, it was just human. It was built to be operated on a human scale, and not with the excessive corporate nature that you run into practically everywhere these days. And I'm so happy that it's still intact, it's still like that.
And it's been very successful for
you. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got Roger Zellers is the guy that deserves all the credit for getting our research numbers in order. He plus two volunteers who were alumni of the house worked for at least 6 months, making phone calls in the late afternoon, early morning, and sometimes on into the evening, just trying to corral information from a cadre of people who had been in the program from 1990 to the year 2000. And I don't have that in front of me now. I don't have any, about 700 people, I think. And they, 700 people who had completed, I forget what the minimum was, but at least a month, I think. So we wanted only to measure people who had been there long enough to have had some touch, some impact from Prospect House. And the aggregate number that they came up with for that 10-year cadre of people still in recovery, was 68%. And they were stunned, like Roger said, he said, he insisted that they run the numbers two or three times, because he couldn't believe it. He didn't imagine it was going to be that good. And often we'd get these pleasant phone calls. We may not have gotten the info direct from the resident, from the alumni, but from his wife or girlfriend or mother or somebody who would answer the phone. And a lot of guys had left pretty reliable phone numbers, surprisingly, because we usually change phone numbers now that we got cell phones as fast and often as we change underwear, just about, But back then, the numbers were more stable. And we got hold of people, and sometimes they'd get hold of somebody and say, no, I don't know where he is or what he's doing. And if you find him, let him stay there, wherever he is.
Get a net on him.
Yeah. I don't care to know where he is. And sometimes they would get that angry response, but we were just stunned by that. And then to maintain that every year since the year 2000, so for the last 23 years, and we will be doing this again very soon, looking at the numbers, looking at the people who came through in 2022, because now it's 2023 in June, so we look at the people for the whole full year of 2022, and we do a round robin to get all the counselors together, and everybody in Prospect House who's a counselor is also, at this moment anyway, an alumni, and is also active in recovery. So they're up and down all over Indiana and Kentucky and greater Cincinnati, and they know things, either through sponsored networks or from personal observation at meetings, because our guys get around. We encourage them to get around, the staff. And we just have four simple categories: sober, not sober, unknown, or deceased. Our numbers have held up consistently over the last 22 years to be over 70%. And it is stunning to think that that's possible, with such a recalcitrant, unruly gang as we alcoholics are. But we are still getting good results. And I think it's only two secret sauce ingredients. One is how long a guy gets to stay, which means that we're in control of the length of stay, because we fly under the radar of managed care. We don't have some 20-year-old cat on the other end of the screen saying, oh, you kept this guy too long, what's wrong with it? We don't have to contend with that. And we also have recovering counselors who have been through the same program. So they've got street cred with the new men who come in, because the new men are very quickly have grasped the understanding that the counselor has been asked himself to do the things that he's asking them to do. So it's not impossible to do. You're not going to be asked to climb Mount Everest barefoot or something. It's something you can do, and you will do. And because we require that as part of the treatment plan, if you're real stubborn and you're refusing to do the work, and sometimes we can't continue to work with you. But usually that works out if we bring a guy down to the staff, talk to him and say, you know, how many more chances do you think you got, you know?
I know that Prospect House has been instrumental in supporting the black community.
Yes.
Like the Black Support Picnic and...
Yes, I think it started in 1988, and I believe that it's one of the things that I'm really proud of. I didn't do it myself. I did write a grant at the beginning that provided transportation and a little extra boost in salary. But Roger Zellers is the guy that deserves credit for that, and he died in 2022. He was a real soldier for recovery. And a real soldier in real life. He was a helicopter crew chief in Vietnam and started a group for in-country Vietnam vets as well. It was very successful and still is going. And it's now called After Wars instead of After Nam, because they realized that the combat vets have the same problems with PTSD and all that as doesn't matter whether you were fighting in the desert or in the jungle or wherever you were. You know, like if you were up against it, that group is meant to help you, and you've got alcoholism or drug addiction. But he started the Black Support Group because of a very incisive understanding that people, African Americans, often don't trust white institutions or institutions that they perceive to be white institutions. Like AA sometimes has a reputation as a whites only kind of club, and of course that isn't true. And one of the things that I'm proud of that Prospect House has done is to help actually integrate AA in Greater Cincinnati. There's a lot of African Americans who you'll see comfortably participating in AA who have been through that experience at Prospect House, and they often will speak very, very fondly of it. But it was designed to let people sort of in an extra private chamber air their dirty laundry, you know, this kind of stuff that they're afraid to talk about at a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They felt comfortable because it was an African American only gathering, and Roger created that and allowed the trust to build to the point. It was like developing a muscle, you know, that finally become you're able to use it, you know, in competition. You know, you can go out and you can lift weights with the best of them. Instead of going, oh, I don't know, it's too big, it's too heavy, you know, you manage. Mm-hmm. When you get experienced, you manage to change, and it's all about change. It practically brings a tear to my eye to think about how many people have changed as a result of coming there, and not only Cincinnati people but Kentucky people. It's amazing, and we would. We would be absolutely pointless if we didn't have people showing up with just that little mustard seed of faith that they could change, or faith that there's hope, faith that change is possible. And I think that's the beauty of AA, is that we learn from each other. That's what got me into treatment, essentially. I found a guy who I'd gotten drunk with, who had gone to Batesville. And I said, is this really a real thing? Are they gonna hurt me, you know? Am I gonna have to shave my head and go to the airport and sell books or chant or something? And he said, no, it's all good. Yeah, I'm gonna hurt you. And he was a terrific guy, and he played guitar nicely and became a chiropractor, moved to California and has a nice boat and on and on, so he's doing okay.
I've heard you talk about the history, not of that building, mm-hmm. the Great Hall, being Prospect House, but what it was previously used for, yeah. And it was moved.
It was moved. That building came up the hill. The Parish House, was the Parish House of Christ Church on East 4th Street, which is now Christ Church Cathedral, the Episcopal Cathedral downtown. And Mary Emery, the lady who invented Marimon, caused that building to be disassembled, bricks numbered, brought up the hill with horses and wagons. That was before the incline was built. And she made that happen, and we got the Parish House. They needed a bigger, better Parish House downtown, because the Parish House downtown was built to serve as a kind of a Cincinnati answer to the Hull House movement, which is in Chicago, which is sort of the foundation of social work in this country. And they wanted the Hull House in Chicago. Jane Addams is the woman that pioneered that. And what Christchurch wanted to do was to emulate that Hull House experience. What they did was work with immigrants, work with the Germans, the Italians, the Irish, sort of train them in how to shop, how to cook American, how the money works, help people find jobs, find training, and all that. Make the immigrant comfortable in this new setting. And it worked so well downtown that they actually outgrew the space, and so they needed a bigger building. And so they brought that building up to us, and when Prospect House started by John Lovett in 1970, he was an Episcopal priest who was an Englishman. Had he stayed in England, or he was actually born of missionary parents in China, but he was a World War II veteran along with Jim Wood. These guys got together, two World War II vets, one Royal Navy and one American Army, and Jim had served in the South Pacific, and Lovett had served around the China Sea in the Royal Navy. And Lovett had been a salt salesman too after he got out of the Navy. He was a very, very colorful guy, very salty guy. And he started Prospect House in 1970, and he also started the Star Center for, that was his first love, was mentally retarded, developmentally disabled people. And that's a separate agency, and that's still in operation in Cincinnati. And so Lovett was kind of the Johnny Appleseed of social service agencies. And this was all while he's serving as the parish priest of the Church of the Nativity, which is the building that sits right next to the parish house and is attached to the parish house. And the parish house now serves to house 30 men at Prospect. It's a great big building. It's three times bigger than the church. So that's why it's way out of scale. Usually a parish house is smaller than a church. But this is the reason it's so big is that it came from another church. And that church was built, our church was built without a parish house. So that building came up the hill, and they also bent it into an L shape. It didn't used to have that L shape. But it's big. It's big enough. It has a kind of a miniature gym inside it, and that was providing an athletic outlet for the immigrants downtown. And it stood ill-used for a long time up in Price Hill before Lovett started there. When he became the priest, they kind of cleared out the parish house. There were a couple of families living in there, pretty raggedy place it was. They had a couple of dumpsters. They had maybe get more than two, to take the debris out of the place before they could get it cleaned up and find bunks and beds and make housing for the new residents. But the lovely origin story of Prospect House that I've always heard, and I've said it often enough now that I'm sure it's true. Say something five times, it's true. But John Lovett was downtown and saying, what about our being able to get zoning so we could do an MRDD program inside that building, inside the parish house, mentally retarded, developmentally disabled people, because it was the people he felt called to serve. And the city came out and inspected it, and it's got a bunch of peculiar back stairs and stuff, and that they said, well, we're not so sure that in case of a fire, people could gather here easily, comfortably. So Lovett, quick on his feet, just stood there for probably no more than 5 seconds, and he said, well, all right, what about alcoholics then? Could we work with alcoholics? And the city said, yeah. Now, either because they thought, I'd like to think this, make the generous assumption, they thought if they're sober, they'll be just as sensible as anybody else. They'll be able to find their way out in case of a fire. But they may have been thinking, well, so what? I hope number two is not the correct interpretation. Yeah. But Lovett was a beauty, and he got the place going, and he was a terrific fundraiser, and he was a terrific writer and thinker, and he laid down a lot of our original policies, and got us going, and developed a little trickle. It was at the time, our budget was very small back then, and I think he found maybe $20,000 a year of federal funding that was coming out of a omnibus bill that had just passed in Congress. Senator Harold Hughes had passed a bill, had written a bill that provided some federal money for alcoholism treatment and rehabilitation and prevention. And Harold Hughes was the first openly recovering senator that I know of. And that was back, he served in the Senate in the 70s, and he wrote that bill, with, you know, on into the, well, late 60s, he got in there. He's a senator from Iowa, and he was a truck driver. He was not a lawyer, you know, before he became a legislator, which may be a good indication. You know, the more practical we are, like Wilbur Dosher being a pipe fitter and a boilermaker. But anyway, I always want to give credit where credit is due, and without Harold Hughes write that bill, there wouldn't have been Cat House, probably, because they were started in the same year, 1970, as Prospect House. And so I think they both, somehow, it was just absolutely providential, you know, they both programs discovered that little trickle of federal money, which of course they've built on since then. It's many times that now, and that's how we were able to work with indigenous people. And, you know, and I think that this is something that's little understood, you know, outside. We understand it inside the alcoholism circles, but outside alcoholism circles, people say, well, all these guys need is a job. Just get them a job, they'll be all right. But what they don't understand is that alcoholics are terrific at finding jobs. We just aren't any good at keeping them. And a lot of people have 10, you know, pay different slips from different companies and when they do their taxes, when they get around to getting sober and remember to do their taxes. You know, there'll be a whole lot of, what do you call them, W-9s, W-2s, yeah. They'll have a sheaf of W-2s, and that's what we do. And what we have discovered at Prospect House is that you have to slow that process down. You have to stop the eagerness to just for the guy to have some money back in his pocket, because that's what gives at least men their sense of authority. You know, like I got 50 bucks in my pocket. I can do anything I want to. And we got to slow that down and slow down the process of getting access to that money. And we have evolved a system that's a treatment model that I think is terrific. And I'm working in my brain now, but not with my pen and not with my keyboard, but I'm working on trying to describe that treatment model because it has worked so well, and we keep improving it, we keep tweaking it, and we've found a way to actually, I think, help alcoholics, and, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that it's possible. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just write us off. They think you're an alcoholic and you're probably never going to change and you're just going to be worthless on down to the end, just riding that comet all the way down to its point of extinction, you know, and your life keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller until it's a casket, and that's about it for you.
Any humorous things, episodes that you can think of while you were at Prospect House?
Oh, too many to count. I remember once, I won't use any names, but this was a guy who was a dual diagnosis guy. He had a second problem with mental illness and sort of a difficulty in adapting to our environment because it was kind of big and noisy. And we had a brand new desk man on. And he called over, and he got a hold of us, and he says, I got a problem, and I don't know what to do. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he says, well, one of our guys is walking around without any pants on. And I said, well, that's not such a big deal. And he says, yeah, but he didn't have any underwear on either. And I said, oh, I see. So I said, well, we'll get over there real quick. And we had a registered nurse working for us at the time, Marcia. She went over there, she marched over there and used her nurse voice, her command voice, and she says, get upstairs! And she didn't bother to explain what the problem was, but she did. He started going up the stairs kind of reluctantly, and I followed him up because I was going to sit with him and explain to him what had happened and why we were barking at him. And so I followed him up the stairs. Man, like you follow a man with no pants on and no underwear on, up the stairs, and he pretty hairy rascal too, I must say. And we got upstairs, and he sits on the bed, and he says, I don't know why everybody's yelling at me. You know, I haven't done anything wrong. I said, well, you know, you don't have any pants on. He says, yes, I do. And I said, I thought to myself, I'm this big brain. I'm a guy who's taught English literature. I can't afford to lose an argument with a man with no pants on about whether he's got pants on or not. So I said, look down. He looks down, he says, oh, shit. So I convinced him, finally, that he didn't have pants on. And he actually, you know, he learned from that, you know, don't come downstairs like that. Make sure you're dressed properly. And he stayed with us, and he stayed sober for a good while after that. He was not kicked out, you know. It was not the kind of uproar that you'd ordinarily expect. We had a lot of tolerance for people for erratic behavior, because most everybody who works there has grown up in an alcoholic family, and it's like a, you know, it's like trying to have breakfast in the middle of a tornado or something. Usually, if you're growing up as a kid, you know, like you just anticipate. You sort of know when the house is about to start rocking and moving around, and then, you adapt very quickly. I mean, alcoholics have a lot of survival skills. I mean, we shouldn't sell ourselves short. We're incredibly resilient, and we've got a lot of we have strong wills too. You know, like that is a key to recovery, I think, if you could figure out a way to park your will outside the room as you enter the AA meeting, you know, you will have understood something crucial. You know, because I like to picture my own will as like a stick, and I need my will, my metaphorical will, to remember to put gas in the car and buy insurance for the car and make sure the car's got tires on it and all that, so it'll carry me to the meeting. But when I get to the meeting, click, I break the stick, you know, like, and then I can walk in. No more will. No, it's not. It's useful and necessary for some tasks, but for other tasks, it is the enemy. And it's like I think I heard somebody say in the Zen Buddhism circles that the mind is an almost all right servant, but it's a terrible master. And I think there's real truth in that. You know, like if you start worshiping your own little 3 or 4 pounds of gray stuff that sloshes around inside your skull, if you think that's it, that that's the final authority on everything, you're screwed.
I just thought, do you find any difference in Alcoholics Anonymous when you came in and what you find in AA meetings today?
Well, I was in with the big smoking debate. We thought that that was going to destroy AA when people started having votes and group conscience meetings on whether we should become a non-smoker meeting. People were getting real nervous about it. Oh dear, you know, like we won't survive this, but we did, and a lot of that's been, I think, a healthy move. And we're again more resilient than we think we are. But I think the current problem that I see is that there's a lot of impatience. There's a lot of competition from the easier, softer way has popped up among us. There are for-profit Suboxone mills for people who have an opiate problem, and that is now being peddled also to alcoholics. And I don't think it works with alcoholism any more than naltrexone used to be.
It's a narcotic antagonist.
Yeah. Well, there was a drug that that was used to. It began with a man, and it was meant to cut down alcohol cravings.
Narcan?
Not Narcan, but it was a.
I don't remember.
It was originally meant to cut down cravings for heroin. Didn't work so well, so they rebranded it and gave it a different name, and said that it would cut down cravings for alcohol. And in any event, I don't believe that these chemical solutions are the kind of thing that. Well, how can I put it succinctly? If you depend upon what you think of as a modern scientific method of defeating or keeping at bay your alcoholism, then you're never going to be forced by the rids, by the restless, irritable, and discontents to work the steps. You're never going to feel like you've got to work the steps. The steps are for these mopes that hang around church basements, you know. That's what the people who are using the modern scientific progressive drug therapy believe. And it may be that there are some people who are using Suboxone who actually work the steps and finally get into real recovery. But I think as long as you're depending on the chemical to block your craving, you will never feel the need to grow. You know, you'll be stuck at there's a ceiling that's been installed, an invisible ceiling, a chemical ceiling above your head, above your spirit, I think, that you'll never break through. And I think it's malpractice. I think people deserve a chance to develop spiritually. If they don't have the capacity, which is, I don't believe there's anybody who doesn't, but people convince themselves they don't, that if there are people like that, well, then let them have access to the MAT, the medication-assisted treatment. But in the meantime, I think people should not be denied the opportunity to have that spiritual growth chance that we get. I've changed my mind about AA, the way it works. I think that it used to be that, you know, what I thought the way the program worked was that you get in and you immediately start working the steps. I now think what you do is you get in and you immediately stop drinking, and then you're going to get so uncomfortable, you're going to get so crazy that you're going to say, geez, I can't go on with this. And then if you've got a good sponsor, he'll say, there is a remedy, you know, there is something you could do to get more comfortable. And you go, yeah, really, what could that be? And then you are introduced to the steps at the point where you need them, you know, like where at first I think if you try to work the steps, it's too much, it's kind of baffling. And you don't want to give up your authority. You don't want to surrender. You don't want to make that gesture, which we've made many times in staff meetings. You know, trying to train people to, you know, this is something that as a man, you know, you're going to have to learn to surrender. Really? Do I have to do that? That's what we make our enemies do. Unconditional surrender. That's what we made the Japanese do by dropping atomic bombs on them. You know, it ain't happened to me yet. I get drunk, I fall down, but it ain't like it's an atomic, not nuclear holocaust or anything. But convincing people that that's the proper use of the will is on smaller projects that can get done. Mm-hmm. You know, not the big stuff, not working with a disease that's trying to kill you. And I think that's a real problem in AA. I think that some meetings are getting smaller because people are choosing that easier, softer way. They're going to MAT programs. They're being directed there by the drug courts of the world. You know, like a lot of, I don't know how it's working in Kentucky, but I'm hearing that about our own Hamilton County Drug Court, that it's a shame that people get in trouble for drugs and then they're being sent to for-profit MAT clinics. And that's an interesting paradox, because then you have to detox off of one more thing because it's an addictive drug.
That's quite the eye-opener, the way you put that.
So I think that's an interesting difference in today, is that we've got competition that we didn't used to have. And when a person is coming into AA and doesn't understand that there's a brother, a sister fellowship, NA, they will sometimes be told irritably by AA members, why don't you go over to NA if you're going to insist on talking about drugs? And I understand that. I understand where it's coming from, because people feel that if people start talking about drugs all the time and that's what the meeting becomes, then the original intention of AA is going to be lost. And the thing that member who's got his firm grip on the early principles of AA feels that that program is not going to be there for the next new person. So he's right to be afraid. He's right to be angry. I don't quarrel with that. But I do think we've got to find a way, some kind of, I'm not smart enough to think of the compromise that will be necessary, but some kind of way to gently include people who need to talk about drugs at first before they can settle down and realize they probably do have a problem with alcohol. And they probably, if their drug of choice were eliminated from the planet by a magic wand, that they would not be content to live clean and sober. They would go find something else to, mm-hmm. you know, drink shoe polish or stick it up their nose or something, you know, like they would do something.
Joe, I talk about filtering shoe polish in prison.
Drinking. Yeah. I didn't know that. Well, I remember interviewing a guy for admission. There's another kind of semi-comical story. Interviewing a guy for admission at Prospect House, and he I said, have you been, I always ask a guy, have you been to the hospital lately? And he says, yeah, I did. And he showed me his arm, he had an abscess on it. And I said, is that from shooting? And he says, yeah. I said, what were you shooting? He said, kerosene. I said, really? that was the one answer that could have surprised me. And I tried not to react to it, but I did. I said, well, did it work? And he says, oh, hell no. It made me sick. And I said, well, I think there's a rule that petroleum products are meant to be kept outside the body. You know?
That's unbelievable.
And I interviewed another guy who, I said, do you have a car? Because it's a problem having a car there, at least when you're in phase one at Prospect House. He said, yeah, I got a car. And then he looks down at the floor, kind of embarrassed. And I thought, well, what's wrong? Is it a junker? You don't want me to know what condition's in or what? And I said, what's the problem with the car? And he said, well, it's in an impound lot. And I said, well, we can maybe help you get it out because that's expensive. You know, they charge a lot every day, you know, in the impound lot. And he says, well, that's just the thing. He says, I'm not sure where the impound lot is. I said, well, we can help you find the impound lot. He says, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, I'm not sure what city it is. And he was sure that the car, he's kind of sure that the car's in an impound lot. I said, where do you think it might be? He says, well, I think it's either Indianapolis, Columbus, or here. I wanted to laugh, but I said, instead I said, well, they're both kind of flat Midwestern cities. I can understand, you know, maybe you can get them confused. Although Cincinnati's got more topographical interest than Columbus or Indianapolis, I think. So people do say some stuff.
Well, I know that we could go on and on. We'll have to have a part two to this.
Yeah, I'm willing.
But any comments that you have to make about the impact that Alcoholics Anonymous Prospect House has made on your life and the person you've become?
Well, I'd say this is a very evolving understanding. I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But I think there's something, I think that AA is actually, it's mysterious. The way it has tapped into the, I mean, this will sound somewhat grandiose maybe, but maybe you'll understand it. But I think that AA has found a way to tap in to the way the universe is organized, if you want to insert yourself benevolently into it. You know, if you want to understand the way you can cooperate with the way this whole thing is set up, not just the earth, but everything. If you insist on quarreling with it and thinking, I'm never going to make peace with this, it's always going to try to chew me up and turn me into hamburger, it's always going to try to hurt me, you'll always get hurt. But if you try to understand the way the laws actually are laid down, it's just like gravity. You know, if you can remember that you were not put on this earth to hurt yourself and not put on this earth to hurt anybody else, and behave that way, and behave according to the golden rule. You know, we're borrowing all this spiritual wisdom from, you know, 3,000-4,000-year-old texts, after all. I mean, it goes way, way back, Old Testament, New Testament, and all the other religions. I'm convinced that Bill W. and Dr. Bob, being grown up in Vermont, not that far away from the Transcendental movement in Massachusetts, you know, that they would have been reading Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and all those guys. And I think that those guys, the Transcendentalists, understood Eastern wisdom. And I think that's one of the wonderful welcoming things about AA, is that it's not doctrinal. It's like a the thing that the wicker that you put up to allow a vine to grow up on it. A trellis. AA is like a trellis. The steps are like a trellis that is free and open. It's got space in it, more space than rules, and it's a trellis up which your own vine can grow. It may go to the left, it may go to the right, but it's a trellis, and that's what the steps are for me. It's a trellis that is teaching us what the fundamental rules of the universe are, and how to insert yourself into that in a benevolent way, so you don't get hurt, you don't get ground up, and you're not in conflict with it. And it is possible. The earth, the world, the cosmos is not a hostile place, actually, I don't think. I thought it was when I was just getting sober. I thought it was here to make me feel ashamed and angry and confused and embarrassed. And that's because that's how I felt all the time and hated myself. And I don't think that's necessary. I think if you can learn how to live in harmony with the way things are laid out, it depends on whether you're a deist or a Christian or what, but it looks as if I noticed that the earth was already spinning when I got born. So one of my early resentments, this was arranged before I got here so I could help. I could have explained how to do it better. But there is something that I can't express. There's something mysterious that AA has tapped into, has intuited, has delivered to people and made it available in a fairly easy, comprehensive way that you can learn how to live with all of the complexities and all the challenges that life will present to you, all the illness, all the morbidity of it, the fatality, the craziness around you, the apparent randomness of the violence that we see in urban life, it is possible to still pick your way through that and have an interesting, productive, creative life. And I can't explain it. I don't know.
Well, I think you just did.
But it is something. It makes a peaceful and productive life possible that I would not have found otherwise. If you'd have given me $1 million and five reams of paper and a typewriter and stuck me in a hotel room and said, all right, I've come up with a program that'll allow you to stay sober, and when you get done with that, I want you to edit it a little bit, amend it, and make it into a program that'll help millions of other people stay sober, I couldn't have done that.
Easy does it.
Yeah. But they did it.
Yeah.
They did it. They were in touch with something that was much larger than they are, that they were, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that connection to the transcendentalist helps me understand the New England nature of the origin of the fellowship. And I'm so glad they got away from the four absolutes too. That would get me out.
Okay. Well, David, I want to thank you for taking time to come over and share your insights and your experience. I mean, it's been wonderful. I miss our conversation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, me too.
Me too.
What is that, arthritis?